chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, and no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. This is the beginning of our second hour. We have on the line from Bristol, England, Tony Godling. Welcome to our program, Tony.
Thank you very much for having me on again, George. I hope you had a nice trip back from Copenhagen.
Oh, yeah. You know what? We flew first class, and the New World Order owns me now.
Why? I doubt it very much.
It didn't take much. But I walked onto the plane, and I automatically, like the sheeple, went to the right, and the stewardess tapped me on the phone. She said, "You get first class this trip back." It was just, we were flying standby on a special rate, but we lucked out coming back. But
lovely.
Anyway, what we want to cover today is, tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll get into comments about the Bilderberg.
Well, George, I worked in the aviation business, and then the BBC, and also environmental campaigning, really trying to look after the environment here in Britain, and now I've got my own radio show. Here in Bristol, where we do basically a politics and investigative journalism radio program. Very difficult to do what you really want to do within the BBC, which is getting tighter and tighter ever since the 1980s and the Tory government, the Conservative government here in Britain, got rid of the last really good program maker as a director general of the BBC and brought in an accountant take his place as the creative director of the organisation, replacing him then with someone called John Burt. Burt brought in effectively a kind of privatisation into the BBC where everything was going to be accounted for, and it stopped the natural success of what was an enormous organisation with lots and lots of people cooperating freely with each other. Everything then after Burt came in had to be accounted for. So I was really witnessing the slow internal disintegration of the BBC as actually a magnificent, potentially magnificent, and it was up until the 1980s, socialist and incredibly organisation where we were working for the state. We were civil servants basically, but what we were doing was for the benefit of the public. And I mean, it's probably not the sort of thing you've come across much in broadcasting over in the US. Maybe PBS is the closest that you have to it over there. But it was a marvellous organisation back in those days. Over the years, it's become more and more commercialised. And, of course, through Tory, generally, Conservative people being appointed to a lot of the key jobs over the last few years, it's really become just a simple tool of the establishment with, rather than adventurous, interesting, creative people in the key positions, the BBC has now got people who are pliable, and spineless in those jobs. And, you know, as we've seen with the way they've reacted to the Jimmy Savile scandal, Britain's biggest ever paedophile working at the BBC many years ago, the way they've dealt with that, and they simply have not tracked down and helped to prosecute people who were cooperating with Savile at the time, that shows just how spineless these people are right to this very day. And we're seeing a real exodus from the current affairs side of the BBC still. I met Michael Crick, who's one of their big correspondents, Paul Mason as well, and even Jeremy Paxman now have left is in the process of leaving Newsnight, which is the flagship national news program, nightly news during the week, and it's like rats leaving the sinking ship, which of course plays into the hands of Rupert Murdoch. This is the problem, is that as the BBC, the state broadcasting, goes down in terms of quality and really good staff, and people are leaving it for the ITN and other news outlets. So what we're seeing is Rupert Murdoch rubbing his hands, and Sky News' audiences are increasing, and we're having what was a state provision of a really good broadcasting service provided back in the 1970s and 1980s being replaced simply by a commercial Murdoch deciding what we can and cannot hear and see.
Right. Tony, the Bilderberg Group is just over with last Sunday, just finished their 4 days of meetings there. And I know I'm airing your Charlie Skelton interview that you did on Friday. And what are some of your final comments on the Bilderberg Group that on this last meeting, the 2014 meeting in Copenhagen?
Well, what I always do, George, is I always scan through, as soon as it comes out, the attendance list, have a good look through, spend an hour or so going through that. Luckily, over the last couple of years, a blogger, I'm not sure of the guy's name, but he's VidRebel, S-V-I-D-R-E-B-E-L, Blogspot, has done quite a good job in teasing out some of the unspoken alliances of the Bilderberg attendees. Say, for example, James Wolfenson puts himself down as some kind of consultant to some obscure firm. Actually, of course, he's the former head of the World Bank. And often, the most important aspect of somebody's CV is not on the list. In fact, it very rarely appears on the list. I mean, you know, even Henry Kissinger, when he's there, it doesn't talk really about his work as you know, Secretary of State, for example, which of course is one of the most important jobs he ever had, but that's not mentioned in the list. So going through the list, I would say it's always fascinating to see the different blend of people attending. One of the things I've seen probably over the last 15 years definitely is more, and if you can imagine it, even more bankers turning up. That is the heads of the big world's big commercial banks, the ones that are the big transnational corporations, which I always say are rather like the medieval Knights Templar, you know, the first multinational corporations, the first people to offer banking checking accounts right across the Western world, right through Europe into the Middle East. You could pay your money in at one of the Templar banks and take your money out somewhere else. And these are the model equivalents of those Knights Templar of old that financed and obviously made a lot of money out of looting through the Crusades back in medieval times. So they are featuring bigger and bigger, HSBC big. But the big change over the last few years, that's just the last sort of 2 or 3 years, is the increase in the number of arms companies and arms firms that attend. We had last year EADS there, which is the biggest arms manufacturer in Europe. I mean, they manufacture just about everything from the most sophisticated fighter interceptor jets, right the way down to landmines, the very nitty-gritty of the war machine. And I really do see that Bilderberg now is becoming the engine room of the warfare state. I mean, if you're looking at the similarities between the aims and objectives of the people from the Council on Foreign Relations, the industry, the bankers who want to finance these people, who are able to finance these people to make massive amounts of money out of plundering resources around the world, plus the toxic mix in with these military types from the arms manufacturers and also from arms policy. Of course, Rory Stewart is a Bilderberger of past years, and he has now taken over as chairman of Britain's House of Commons Defence Select Committee, which oversees Britain's $90 billion, I think it's around about £50 billion, $90 billion defence budget. So wherever you look, you see Bilderberg taking over control of defence policy. And it was also very, very wonderful to see and amusing to see that Ed Balls, the Shadow Chancellor here in Britain, had so much trouble getting in. I mean, you probably saw that episode yourself, George.
Yeah, he fumbled around with a lot of paperwork, isn't he? The Shadow Chancellor or something like that?
Well, this is the irony of that. Yeah, he is the Labour Party's Shadow Chancellor. That is, say, the Chancellor in waiting. It's quite feasible that the Labour Party will get in next year's general election here in Britain, and he's the guy who will be in charge of the Treasury if they do. And it was ironic, I thought, that it was him out of everybody that had trouble getting into the venue. He is the one person in Britain who should be really talking to the demonstrators outside, the protesters, and really raising questions about what are Bilderberg up to. He is supposed to be representing the working class people right across Britain, and he is also in a very powerful position, being possibly in charge of the nation's finances next year. And he's in a position to actually cut a deal, possibly with the Bilderbergers, but certainly also to make a call for their more transparency. If anybody in that meeting should be the sort of person that shouldn't be really throwing his lot in with these people and questioning what they're doing and putting a little bit of a pull on, saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, there are millions of people relying on what we're doing in here, and, you know, let's have a little bit more openness. It should have been him. So I think, in a way, it was Providence shining down and saying, hang on, Ed Balls, you're just trying to stroll into this meeting. Maybe you should be thinking twice before you do that.
Right. I understand. Wasn't there a jogger that went out at one time on Saturday?
Well, listen, George, it's really, I mean, I don't know, when I was going to these meetings in the early 2000s,
sure.
Several times I came across participants, always politicians, that were quite clear to me as a journalist covering it, and in those days, of course, it was just a handful, two or three journalists on the outside, people like Chris Bolin, taking photographs for the American Free Press, and a handful of us. Now, what would happen was the participants quite irregularly, the meetings, a couple of them would come out to have a chat with us.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the politicians even tried to smuggle out a attendance list, because they would never release those beforehand in the old days. And he was had the attendance list taken off of him by one of the Bilderberg security before he left the conference. Actually frisked. And they said, oh, what's this doing in your pocket? You can't take that out. You know, he was actually coming out to help us, really, with the coverage by giving a list of people who were in there to us. I'm trying to think of the name of the guy. I can't remember now. But anyway, he was a politician. He had said, when he came out to have a chat with us, he said, oh, it's great to see you guys. Well done for covering the conference. And he said, the atmosphere inside there is horrible. He said, really tense, really nasty.
Right.
And also he said, the cigarettes are really expensive, at which point he popped into a local shop and bought himself some cigarettes for the normal street prices. And he had a couple of cigarettes with us, bought himself a drink, and, you know, we had a good chat about what was going on inside. So the politicians, people don't necessarily understand this, the politicians who are in there aren't always in league with the Bilderbergers. Obviously, they realise that they need the finances in order to carry on. At any point, these banks can pull the finances out from underneath their politicians. But at least some of them have got a bit of spine and are prepared to come out and talk to journalists like you, George.
Right. I understand the jogger that did speak to the crowd came out at about the time that Niels Harriet was speaking. And as my understanding, several of the crowd or a portion of the crowd ran down to the fence where the jogger was, the Bilderberger, to talk to him, and it subtracted away somewhat from the crowd that Niels Harriet was speaking to about 9/11.
So. Well, I think the whole business of 9/11, of course, is absolutely crucial in much of this, because the only way the warfare state, as I like to call it, as I think this was a phrase coined by Philip Agee back in the 1970s, that, you know, there was a massive military-industrial complex out there that was looking for war. Really, the only way that they can get their way is through propaganda, control of the press, control of the media, control of what people can and can't see. But, of course, since those days, we've got the internet, and I'm sure many of the politicians inside would have, not necessarily secret, but certainly have some idea of questions about the September 11th attacks. I mean, when you've got the head of the U.S. Army War College also saying that Israel may be behind the 9/11 attacks, I'm sure our politicians, if our military are asking these questions, I'm sure our politicians are too, George.
Right. There was, Keith Alexander was in there and several others. Petraeus was there. And this thing about privacy, internet privacy, they're going to close it down, aren't they? They don't care about letting us talk to each other anymore, do they?
They want us to talk to each other, but they're going to be watching everything. Now, I'll tell you one thing, George. I wrote a piece for Russia Today recently, which was about internet privacy. It was called social media is a weapon of war and you are the target. That was the headline. And I sent that off to Rush Today, whatever it was, I think it was Thursday or something. And the article hadn't appeared on the Rush Today website. So I just texted my boss there casually on the Monday saying, well, was something wrong with the article? Why didn't it appear? And she said, what article? She'd been using a Gmail account, and the article had simply been sent to that Gmail account, and Google or the NSA or somebody had just deleted it from the account. So she'd never got the article, which was so critical of Google. And I would suggest, you know, your listeners have a look at the article if they can manage to get themselves to a computer and internet and things. Because, you know, what I'm explaining there is that actually what's happening is that these big internet companies that are in bed with Bilderberg, I'm talking about LinkedIn, Amazon, I'm talking about Facebook, Google, these guys, Microsoft, of course, these guys are actually now just fronts for the NSA. They have become nothing really. They're not getting any revenue from their individual customers, so they really see us as superfluous, and they're not fighting in the courts for our privacy at all anymore. In fact, what they're doing is they're using the courts to fight against actions which individuals, private individuals, are taking against them, and that article really just details some of that. So what happened was that Russia Today people were explaining to me is that they were sending emails from the Russia Today RT official, you know, the sort of bespoke .ru email addresses out to their correspondents around the world. And many of them who were using Gmail accounts were not getting those emails. Possibly, almost certainly, Google was deleting them, or somebody was getting in through the back of Google, like the NSA, and deleting those emails. So what they found was that by switching over to Gmail addresses at Russia Today, people then started getting the information that Russia Today was sending out. So you can see how pernicious this all is, and how that has been, you know, very few people know about this, George. But what's happening is there's been interference in using Gmail, and that interference has been used to sort of say, well, if you use Gmail, will you actually get your emails eventually? So what they've done is they've swapped now, and they've started using, you know, I basically send to a Gmail account and to the RT's own accounts, and the articles then get through. But this is pretty sophisticated cyber warfare. There's not a lot more steps in this between this and all-out cyber warfare against journalists in the West, George.
You know, Farrell, my co-producer of our symposium over there, and I experienced the same thing. We couldn't keep our batteries up on our handheld phones over there.
Oh, well, that's another problem. What could be happening there is people hacking into your phone in order to use your juice up, basically.
Right. And that's what, and then we came back to Austin here, Austin, Texas, and there's no problem. We're charging up our phones. They're staying charged up all night. There in Denmark, in Copenhagen, we couldn't keep our phones charged up overnight, you know?
Yeah, this is what's going on, I think, is all sorts of cyber interference. They're playing little games, the idea being, you know, I would suggest, though, that all these kinds of things should be reported to the police. If it looks as if there's some kind of hacking going on with your phone, just make a police report about it, because the ordinary local civil police are actually quite interested in these kinds of things and can possibly help to do something about it. And if they don't know, because of course that kind of manipulation of the telecommunications network is in, I don't know about the US, but certainly here in Britain, is a criminal offence on some quite serious levels and on several possible different criminal offences. But we've seen also this week, George, in court here, I mean, some pretty horrendous stuff that I'd never thought I'd see in my lifetime, which is secret courts now in Britain being used for terrorist charges. We've just only just yesterday been told that there's a terrorist court case taking place. It was only because the BBC and other media took legal action in London at the High Court to get the fact that a court case was taking place released to the public. We were not even allowed to know, not only was this a secret trial, but we weren't even allowed to know that a secret trial was going to take place. So this is the extent to which the justice system is being torn to shreds here in Britain. I mean, we've got also at the same time Kenneth Clark, who, of course, is the top Bilderberg Steering Committee guy in the UK, when he was Lord Chancellor, he introduced this Criminal Justice Bill, which has allowed these secret courts, but it's also dismantled what we call over here legal aid, which is help for the poorer people to get access to justice. Our judicial system is under assault like never before in its history, and we've even had barristers out on the street for the very first time in history across the country protesting about the way that justice in Britain is being destroyed. It doesn't seem like the present government is going to be prepared to do it. Anything about it.
Right. They were talking about several things within inside there. Of course, they keep it secret. But this recent gas agreement between Russia and China, I guess China came out pretty well on that price-wise, as I understand.
Well, yeah, but it's the implications for geopolitics that are so important with that. I think what's happening is that the US and the NATO countries, really, I mean, we're starting to see, aren't we, since 9/11, Europe and the US, that is to say the EU and the US, performing almost as one bloc. And that doesn't surprise me, because if you look at the big corporations and banks that are in control of lobbying policy throughout US and Europe, it's the same companies. The EU is completely undemocratic. We've got this farcical situation of a new president being selected for the European Union. And it looks like it may even be made, not by the people, there's been no election about it, it's just a few of the top politicians who are going to decide at the Council of Europe. And the guy it looks like they're going to be choosing is the former president of Luxembourg. Now, hang on a minute, Luxembourg is the mecca of tax evasion. So what are they doing sticking him in charge? I mean, somebody nobody's ever heard of in Europe, of course. But if this is the way that the technocracy is being run, by people who have got absolutely no contact with the real world, George, and that seems to be the way we're going towards a US and EU power block. And the Russians and the Chinese, of course, they're looking at this and they're saying, well, we're not having this, you know, and so they're banding together as well. What the US and Britain particularly, and other countries in Europe have done, and I guess the Israelis too, is really to force China and Russia to cooperate more and more, so that they're going to be, I think, in the future, possibly even one giant power block. And, you know, we're starting to get towards this kind of crazy idea of 1984, you know, where you've got these constant warring factions across the world. But at least there is still some dialogue and discussion, with the Russians making sure, more than anybody else, the Chinese don't seem to be particularly into free speech, but the Russians more than ever making sure that there is free discussion. I want to say one other thing as well, which is about Al Jazeera and the fascinating, I mean, we've seen big attacks on the Qataris over the last, really, 6 or 8 months, starting here in Britain with attacks on the Qatari racehorse owners. And this is quite clear to me. It's obvious. We've seen, just in the last week, big attacks on the Qataris for apparent corruption and bribery, which, of course, always goes on, in the World Cup, which is coming up soon, which is coming to Qatar after this next one. So, you know, this is what the reason for it is really simple, is Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is doing a really important international job there and getting good discussion, good debate, high-quality debate going, and in the English language. And in fact, for example, in Ukraine, the Russia Today has been quite pro-Putin and pro-Russia. The Western media has been totally anti. It's been pro the coup government, you know, the Pravi sector people and the new Kiev junta. And Al Jazeera has done an absolutely brilliant job of playing a kind of middle line and looking at both sides, which is exactly what we all need. Balanced media, and they've got their knuckles wrapped for their trouble by simple propagandistic news stories designed to attack the Qatari royal family. Of course, the Saudi Arabian government have also withdrawn their embassies in Qatar, so they're being used as a tool by the West too. And you know, it's great to see that the Qatari royal family have got a bit of spine, a bit of backbone, and are prepared to show the world and put Qatar on the map.
Right, those five recent Taliban were released, and they're in Qatar now, as I understand it, walking the streets.
Well, that's right. It's interesting, isn't it, how things change over the years, you know, that one place or another place might be seen as a more of a safe haven, somewhere that's allowing maybe both sides in these big conflicts to get together in peaceful surroundings and not, you know, criminalizing them so that we can have debate and discussion. You know, we've seen also with the military coup in Thailand over the last week or so, and that's fascinating to see how the people have been dealing with that. I was reading earlier that the protesters, obviously, they're throwing up their hands in disbelief. What on earth is going on? You know, we've been fighting for more democracy, and what we've got is less. I think probably people in Egypt, George, are thinking exactly the same, you know.
Yeah.
You know, which is an appalling situation where you just ban the opposition and then you have an election with no opposition and you get in and they call it democracy in the West now.
Yeah.
But in Thailand, what they've been doing is going out onto the streets with, rather than with having sort of mass protests, screaming and shouting, with these amazing, like, it's almost like Gandhi-style tactics, with hundreds and hundreds of people turning up with copies of 1984 in Thai, you know, and just basically sitting down in the road, having a big protest, and just reading 1984. In fact, sometimes reading it, little bits of it out to each other. So they're saying that confrontation is not the way. Actually, what it's all about is education. And this is, of course, what the Western elites particularly hate, is an educated population. And what the Thai protesters are showing us is this is a one wonderful way to show that we are not ignorant. We're not watching your rubbish news media that's lying to us constantly. We're sitting around and we're reading 1984. We know exactly what you're up to. And I just think that sends a wonderful message around the world of non-violent resistance and a really educated, intelligent population.
Right. It calls to mind Shelley when he said at the end of the great poem, "We are many and they are few," but I rewrote that line a little bit, like, "We are few but shrewd, and we are many but ignorant." You know what I mean?
Well,
they are few but shrewd, and we are many but ignorant. So this education thing that we're doing, and you've devoted your life to it, haven't you?
Well, that's,
you know,
that's right,
continue
George.
Continue doing this. And you're doing some excellent programming, Tony.
Well, thank you. But you see, you're right. I mean, we had a look, for example, I pitched a little interview that you did with the author of The Brothers, about Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it's great to be able to sort of, in a way, we've got a little special relationship, you and I, George, across the Atlantic, where you know, you pinch a bit of my stuff, I pinch a bit of yours, and actually what we're doing is, we're kind of educators, I think, a little bit of the population, without wishing to sound, you know, too highbrow, where we discover interesting stuff. I mean, people may call us conspiracy theorists, but actually, of course, there is a conspiracy, and the conspiracy is to steal the resources of the planet. That's the prize. For many people, this is an obsession. They just want more and more money, even though they've got already more money than they could ever spend. And it's a really nasty beggar-thy-neighbor kind of philosophy which they hold. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term over there, George.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about
that. Well, a beggar thy neighbor means that you want to see the people around you poor and hungry and starving.
Yeah.
And that actually that's where you get off, basically, because you can see that you've got more than them. It's a bit like keeping up with the Joneses next door, you know, this kind of thing. But it's about seeing those around you impoverished, and that somehow makes you feel stronger and better, because basically you're a very inadequate person. And, of course, these are the types of people who are being funneled up into positions of power right across the West today, because they're insecure, they're easily pliable. It's a kind of character type trait that seems to be in big demand. And that's why so many of our services are not being delivered properly. We see failings in all sorts of parts of society because many of these people are being promoted at the expense of people who've got real talent, George.
Right, that's a problem, isn't it? Would you say that their psychology is like, could be described as sociopathic or psychopathic type of behavior or what?
Well, yeah, the sociopaths and the psychos are the ones at the very top. But I think you've got a lot of people who are kind of weak-minded who they like to use. I mean, we've also got the other thing. I mean, we're talking about education just now. I think we've got a very, very, I mean, I don't know about the United States, but certainly in the UK, we've got a very well-educated youth. These are people who've been brought up on the internet. They've never watched television, many of them. They're just as cynical as you and I are. And they're very, very cynical about their governments. And, you know, I think that's actually a marvelous resource well-educated, even extremely well-educated. I mean, a lot of youngsters today, I just look at them and I think, well, it's amazing how much you know compared to how much we knew at your age. There's been an explosion of knowledge, I think, since the early 1990s particularly, and the birth of the internet. And that, of course, there are attempts now to close that down. There's attempts with the secret courts here in Britain, and there's also what they call super injunctions now over here, where you cannot report that something has happened. So somebody goes to court and gets an injunction saying that although this all happened and it's all true, you're not allowed to report it. And on top of that, we've got this new weird thing, which is exactly what the NSA love, and those reputation management people like Bell Pottinger, these enormous firms that will you pay thousands, tens of thousands of pounds to, who will manage your reputation for you. And those companies, what they're doing is they've successfully lobbied Google to do this thing called the right to forget. So you fill in a little form on Google, at least that's the case here in Europe now, and Google, if you're successful, Google will then just delist some embarrassing story about you, content on the internet somewhere, from their listings. Hopefully this will be the demise of Google and the end of Google once people know that some of the most important juicy facts of the rich and powerful are no longer on Google. You know, so there is this really is, again, coming back to Orwell, is the Ministry of Truth. What they're doing is they're just erasing bits of history that are inconvenient. And now in this sort of anarcho-capitalist world we're living in, where money is everything and the law is nothing, laws are just overridden, and money just will buy you a sanitized version of you on the internet.
Right. We've got the Atlantic Alliance. That's Tony and Georgie. You know what I mean? Now, you talk about this Atlantic trade thing as being very important. Of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is also important, but you're saying that they probably really focus in on this too, you think?
At Bilderberg.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. This is exactly the sort of Bilderberg. I mean, you know, these are the guys that came up with the European Economic Community, the Euro. What they're trying to do is tie together the vast areas of the planet, of planet Earth, using single currencies and single trade agreements. And what they realize is that if you've got single trade agreements and single currencies right across these the planet, then actually the corporations that operate across those boundaries, across those national boundaries, because of the destruction of exchange controls, which happened in the 1980s mainly, where countries relinquished control of money flowing in and out of their own countries, but actually it's the corporations that then rule those countries, that they can play one government off against another. They're now in the wonderful position from their point of view, the hellish position from our point of view, of having those governments in massive amounts of unpayable debt. So, you know, the borrower is servant to the lender. The governments are subservient to the banks and the big corporations across the Western world now. And so this agreement is right up Bilderberg Street. You know, it's going to undermine governments' abilities to take on these corporations with laws. In the old days, what the corporations would do if a government introduced a law which they didn't like, say, for example, to regulate them, for example, then they would just move out of the country. Now what they're going to be able to do under the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is even more worse than that. It's basically to sue the government and for compensation for any lost profit. So this is right up Bilderberg Street, and it's just a massive amount of power being funneled into the hands of a tiny number of unaccountable people. The other thing to make clear about the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership is nobody has been asked about this, consulted. This is an edict from on high, which is being foisted on the people with no parliamentary debate, certainly here in Britain, and no discussion in the press. It's not been mentioned in the press hardly, apart from a couple of articles by some particularly good investigative writers. And so we are now living in the age where some of the most important changes to the way we live our lives are just being forced upon us. And, you know, this is definitely the route to a kind of fascism, where you've got big corporations, as they were in Hitler's day, you know, companies like IG Farben, Krupps, the arms manufacturers, are actually dictating now to our governments about what they should and shouldn't do, which is why it's so important that our politicians that are in meetings like Bilderberg have got a bit of spine to them. Unfortunately, they're mostly like jelly-like, and they seem to be just doing whatever the Bilderbergers want them to do, George.
Well, they are. We have a couple of minutes left, Tony. Do you have any concluding remarks for our audience?
Well, I mean, I think always when you're talking about some of these depressing, dark subjects, it's important to look for some light at the end of the tunnel. And, of course, there is. I mean, you know, what we've seen in with our youth particularly is a questioning, suspicious-minded young generation that's going to be very, very difficult to hoodwink. If, for example, they try and push ahead with this backing of the fascist regime in, or at least partly fascist regime in Kiev, then I don't think people are going to go along with this. I mean, they may be able to do it like they've done with the previous wars, but what's happening is a solid war is coming up between our rulers and our population, and that although these rulers may be able to get away with these various crimes, they are losing the support of the population, and there's this barrier coming up, which actually is quite a good thing, that we don't see our governments as legitimate as they start to go off and do their own thing. You know, because what happens then is you start to get civil society helping. I mean, one of the amazing things we've seen here in Britain, with the massive increase in poverty since 2010, when this coalition government came to power and started really cutting off people's food supply and food benefits, this kind of thing, where people are starting to starve, is, you know, you've seen communities coming together, you know, church groups flourishing, and you've seen, you know, society almost starting to heal itself from the bottom up. And you combine that with an educated youth, you've got a pretty explosive mix of you know, people who can fuel a kind of velvet revolution, which is a revolution in consciousness. I was going to go back to Thailand and see what's happening over there. That's absolutely marvellous to see that people are saying, well, hang on a minute, we know exactly what you're up to. You might be able to fool a few of us, but you're, day by day, less and less people are conned by this sick and twisted system that you're developing. And as you start to distance yourself from the public, well, the public's starting to distance themselves from you, and they don't need you anymore.
Well, Tony, well, thank you. Well, that was a great concluding remark there. And we certainly do thank you very much this evening for your remarks and your fine interview. But thank you so much.
Okay, George, and well done for all the work you've done over in Copenhagen and the Bilderbergers over the years, and God bless.
Okay, thank you. Good night.